No one bothered him. No one even looked at him as he walked along the hall of the 21st story of a luxury high-rise, kicking in doors. He came to another door where no lights appeared to be on inside. He knocked and waited. When no one answered, he knocked harder. It took a dozen good kicks to break this door in. But no one came to investigate the racket. If they had, Peter would have explained who he was and how important it was that he get his hands on a telescope. As it was, he went inside, called out to confirm no one was home, then spotted a telescope by the window. Sitting on a stool beside it, Peter peered into the eyepiece and scanned the endless sky until he found what he was looking for. It was up high, so all he could see was the bottom. Scanning lower in the sky, he spotted another. This time he could see the top. It was a neighborhood, raised ranch houses, lawns, pools, suburban streets ending in a ragged, broken edge, as if it had been dug out of the ground by a giant excavator or yanked like a weed. There was a six-pack of beer in the refrigerator, still cool if no longer cold. He pulled one, twisted off the cap, and drained half of it. What had he done? People would die, billions of people, because of him. He drained the rest of the beer, opened a second. As he drank it, he wondered if the windows of the apartment were shatterproof, or if he could throw a chair through one and jump out after it. Given the laws of physics, as Peter understood them, this was impossible. Chunks of the Earth's crust couldn't hover in the sky, and the people on those chunks couldn't possibly be alive. The only quasi-rational explanation was that the singularity had completely reformed their world, given it new properties. In theory, singularities could create universes, so it wasn't impossible. Peter went back to the window and looked out. It was almost evening, the sky fading from blue to gray. Gravity was still acting on smaller objects, so it must be working on the large islands hanging in the air. If he assumed that, then some other force was holding the islands aloft. Some force pulling from space? This piece of Manhattan reminded him of the singularity hanging suspended between two forces. The other possibility was just that, repulsion. Steepling his hands and pressing them to his mouth, Peter pictured a million tiny islands, locked together because each repelled the others surrounding it. On the subatomic level, this was commonplace. Given the Pauli exclusion principle, any two electrons with identical properties repelled each other. If those quantum properties now applied to macroscopic objects, or if these chunks of land had some type of charge that made them repel each other, the world outside Peter's window would be possible. He drained the last of his beer, tossed the bottle onto the spotless ivory carpet. Numb, wondering if his friends were all right, he went to the refrigerator and got a third beer. What would tomorrow be like, with a million souls living on this island, with no power and limited resources? Chapter 50. Fowler pretended he was utterly engrossed in eating his lunch. And to some extent he was, because it was damn good. Spaghetti and tomato sauce. While eavesdropping on a conversation at the next table. Nothing's going to change, Peter 11 was saying. We're going to stay filthy in their eyes. One? One? Fowler suddenly remembered that was his name. Someone had called it at least a half dozen times. Peter 26 was standing at a distance, as if afraid to approach. Sorry. Hard to get used to the new name. I keep expecting people to call me 131. Peter 26 smiled a little tightly and nodded. Defense wants to see you. Oh, all right. Who was Defense? If he was going to play the head injury card, now was the time. But if he could avoid it, he'd like to. It might raise suspicion, especially if his odd behaviors started piling up. 17? Peter 17 looked up, fork hovering above his plate. Take a walk with me to Defense? Sure, Peter 17 stood eagerly. Fowler gave him an after you gesture and followed him out. I asked you to join me because I wanted to talk to you about the strategy. Peter 17 glanced at him. You know, I'm behind you. Whatever you decide. I don't doubt that, but I know you have your own opinions, and I want to hear them. I'm wondering if maybe we need a bolder plan. Peter 17 laid out his thoughts for open resistance to their low status on Ugo's world. He argued that Ugo was keeping them where they were out of hatred for Sandoval, and always would, that they were smarter and more capable than anyone on this island, and shouldn't allow themselves to be treated like scum. He kept talking as they walked along a brick sidewalk, speaking quickly and passionately, probably seeing it as his one chance to make his case directly to the big kahuna. If only he knew who he was speaking to. When a group of Natalie-dressed people appeared, heading toward them, Peter 17 led Fowler into the street, giving them a wide berth. Fowler waited until they were out of earshot, then asked Peter 17 if he thought it was possible to take Ugo out. 17's eyes got huge. Don't joke like that. I've never been more serious. They'd tear us apart and throw us off the edge a piece at a time. What if we didn't stick around to be cut into pieces? What if we hijacked Harriers? Ugo's the one who hates us. If he were dead, would the rest of them waste their time chasing us? Peter 17 looked at the road. I need some time to digest what you're suggesting. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but it makes me nervous to discuss it even here. He looked more than nervous. He looked terrified. All right. We'll talk more another time. Looking into the sky, Fowler thought of the orchid world, turning upside down. He'd invented the thing that did that, the thing that had the power to tear the whole world apart. If he could do that to stone and sky, he could figure out a way to kill Ugo. Once Ugo was dead, he could see Storm again. They'd figure out a way to help people. He'd like to return to Daisy and the rest of his tribe in a harrier packed with food, medicine, and power. What an entrance that would be. He grinned, imagining Daisy's and Orchid's expressions when he stepped out of that harrier. Peter 17 led him down a road flanked by big, squat buildings, surrounded by parking lots. It was a warm day, the sun beating on Fuller's head. They walked in silence, Peter 17 probably mulling what Fowler had suggested. They passed a billboard, a giant picture of Ugo's face, sporting a humble, almost coquettish smile. Peter 17 led him through a gate. A guard, dressed in fatigues, nodded as they passed. The dozens of buildings beyond the gate were a mix of old, crumbling, factory-looking structures, renovated buildings that were shiny new material built on the bones of the old, and a few brand-new glass and steel structures. Peter wanted to ask Peter 17 who exactly defense was, but that would be admitting too much ignorance. Peter 17 led him into the most imposing of the renovated buildings, past a checkpoint guarded by two serious-looking military types, along a hall, downstairs, past a heavy door, and into a large room. The room was packed with technology of all sorts, all of it lit and operational. At the far side, a small steel chamber with a thick window stood alone. Dozens of people sat at stations, including two Peters, one with B on his sleeve, the other E. They were sitting side by side, wearing goggles, hard at work. Their gloved fingers tapped keys and waved at the air as if there was something there Fowler couldn't see. "Go on," Peter B. said without looking up. "Go look at it. You know you want to." Peter 17 headed toward the steel chamber. "I know I do." Fowler followed, looked over Peter 17's shoulder at a ball of utter blackness. The sight made his balls shrink. The sphere was blacker than he'd known black could be, blacker than the tunnels he and Storm had stumbled through on her world, fleeing people with knives and axes. He knew what it was immediately. Defense. It meant protecting yourself, but sometimes it meant military, the place where the weapons were held. When they returned, Peter B. glanced at the number on Peter 17's sleeve and said, "Wait outside." Without a word, Peter 17 spun on his heel and left. Evidently, letters trumped numbers in the Peter hierarchy. Peter B. eyed Fowler. "Congratulations." "Thank you." "Now, since you're the new number one, listen up." "All right." Peter B. eyed him suspiciously, as if there might have been a hint of sarcasm in his reply. You need to keep your people in line. We know they're unhappy with all the classwork. We hear the complaints. Keep them motivated. Just because we've recovered the singularity doesn't mean they can relax. We could always use more of them.
I see.
It made a certain sense. If you have exact copies of the man who created something, teach them what he knew, and they could create it as well. A couple of your people are getting way out of hand with the complaining. And that guy, Peter B. pointed at the door, 17 is at the top of the list. If he and the others like him don't settle down, I'm going to wipe them clean. Paula nodded, trying to appear concerned about Peter 17's bad behavior. I'm serious, Peter B. went on. We've got all the B virus in the world, and I'm not afraid to use it.
I don't doubt you, Fowler said earnestly. I'll do everything I can to settle them down.
Peter B. seemed satisfied. He moved on, briefing Fowler on various mundane aspects of his new position. Being king of the scum wasn't going to be terribly glamorous. This ends Disc 9. Fowler, Disc 10. Chapter 51. A bottle, peeking up in the back of the little pantry in his room, caught Fowler's eye. Pushing boxes and jars aside, he drew out a tall, square bottle made of brown glass with a black label and white lettering. Unmistakably, a booze bottle. Fowler had only seen a handful before, but had made a point of remembering what they looked like. He unscrewed the cap and sniffed, savoring the sharp, acrid scent as he silently thanked the real 131 for his foresight. He took a swig, but just a small one. This was something to be savored. The burn in his throat brought back memories of the last time he'd had booze. While hunting for food, he and Fish had found a half bottle of clear stuff in a 50th or 60th floor apartment under the bed of what had obviously been some teenaged boy's room. Their excitement at the find had fueled enough adrenaline for them to race up the last 10 stories to the roof, where they'd passed the bottle until it was empty, then whooped and howled and jumped around like idiots until they fell asleep. Fowler took another drink, a bigger one. That night with Fish, the booze had taken away his doubts and fears like nothing ever had. Fowler hoped it would do the same tonight. The more he drank, though, the sadder and lonelier he felt. He kept seeing Snakebite's face, his eyes vacant and unseeing, his hair snapping in the wind. Fowler withdrew the slender communicator from its hiding place in his boot, turned it over. He could reach out across all those miles right now, bring Storm here to him, although they'd agreed it was a bad idea for him to contact them until he was ready to leave. Fowler took another drink, then slipped the photo of him and Storm out of his boot as well. In his mind, it would always be Storm in the photo. He thought about what Melissa had said, that it hurt her to see them together. He wondered if he would have fallen in love with Melissa if he'd met her first. This was such a complicated situation. All he could do was follow his heart, and his heart said he loved Storm. Fowler pressed the button in the center of the walkie-talkie, then moved it to his ear.
Hi, Melissa said. What's happened?
Funny how he could tell it was Melissa from just a few words.
Nothing, really.
They're teaching us physics, and I'm now the leader of the Peters.
Are you drunk?
He lifted the bottle, studied the level of the liquid inside.
Not as drunk as I will be.
Have you seen Ugo?
I saw him. He's a smarmy prick.
Melissa burst out laughing.
Can I talk to Storm?
Silence on the line.
That's why you called, isn't it?
You're drunk and mooning for your girlfriend. Another pause.
Fowler?
Storm said.
Fowler laughed with delight. It just burst out of him.
Yes, he was drunk, and it felt good. I just had to call to tell you I love you.
He took another swig from the bottle. Some of it sloshed out of the corner of his mouth, splashing on 131's standard-issue brown blanket. He looked up to find Peter, too, standing in the doorway, his hand on the doorknob.
Are you out of your mind? I have to go. Fowler lowered the walkie-talkie.
Peter, too, yanked him off the bed, dragged him down the hall and into the darkness of the quad.
How bad was that head injury? Bad enough to forget the cameras?
What? Fowler's mouth felt thick and awkward, unable to form words properly. Peter, too, studied him, scowling.
What happened to you out there?
He pressed his hand over his forehead. Look, if you have something going on with a woman, that's your business. But you just flaunted it in Wolkoff's face. Number one or not, they're going to come after you for it. Peter, too, thought Fowler had been talking to a secret lover. But surveillance cameras? Wolkoff's people had been watching? Fowler tried to remember what he'd said to Melissa and Storm. Had there been anything that would give him away? Nothing he could recall. He'd called Wolkoff a prick. Told Storm he loved her, but he hadn't called Melissa by name. A cold dread washed over him. The photo. He'd taken out the photo of him and Melissa. He was dead. They were probably on their way. His friends would never reach him in time. Peter, too,'s eyes narrowed. You did it on purpose, didn't you? Your memory can't be that far gone. You did it to force us to act. Paula's racing pulse slowed. He gave Peter, too, his best calm, level stare. That's right. Peter, too, shook his head in wonder, whispered, You crazy bastard. Someone had to wake us up. We can't spend the rest of our lives with our heads bowed, stepping into the gutter to let people pass. I'd rather be dead. Peter, too, considered him with something bordering on awe. It wasn't luck that you were the one who got Sandoval. You're a leader, a true leader. He nodded. All right, one. I'm willing to die for a chance to live. Tell me what you want to do. That was the question. 150 unarmed Peters couldn't take on an army. And as soon as the Peters learned who Fowler really was, Fowler would have no allies at all. All he could possibly hope to accomplish was to take Ugo with him, though even that seemed unlikely. Ugo wasn't going to show his face until Fowler was dead. Peter, too, waited for orders. I'm going to defense. Can you get me a gun? Maybe he could force someone to use the singularity to kill Ugo. Come on. Peter, too, led Fowler away from the campus at a jog toward a side street and stopped in front of a small white house. Wait here. Peter, too, paused, added, You're not the only one with a girlfriend. It felt as if Peter, too, were inside a long time, but that was probably because Fowler was so painfully aware of each second ticking by, moving him closer to being found out. Finally, Peter, too, came out, pressed close to him, lifted his t-shirt, and slid a handgun into his belt. Try to convince the man to rise up, Fowler said. I'm going after Ugo. He turned to go, then had an idea. Hold on. Peter, too, turned back. Would you give me your shirt? Peter, too, pulled his shirt over his head, handed it to Fowler, held out his hand to accept Fowler's in return. We should probably toss this one in the bushes. It might as well have a target drawn on it. Too shook his head, pulled it on. It might buy you time. Fowler clapped Peter, too, on the shoulder, feeling terrible. If Too survived, he would hate himself for being duped into helping the monster Peter Sandoval. He'd never understand that Fowler didn't know Peter Sandoval any better than he did. As Fowler ran toward defense, he called his friends. Storm answered. Everything's gone to shit. He jumped a low stone wall on the edge of the campus. Cutting across the sidewalk, he almost collided with a young couple. Sorry, he called over his shoulder as he crossed a street, then into the phone. If you don't hear from me within 2 hours, go ahead and jump. See what you can find below this world. Don't waste any more time. No, we'll come and get you. She was fighting back sobs. It's too late. Fowler worked to keep his emotions in check. He needed his air to run. His lungs were already burning, his thighs rubbery, his shoulder wound shrieking from the jostling. The booze made him feel as if he were running on slanted pavement. He cut down a tree-lined side street. It was a long shot from the start. At least the rest of you will be safe. Surely Ugo wouldn't bother chasing the others once Fowler was dead. A helicopter thumped in the distance. Fowler ducked under a tree, leaned on the rough bough to steady himself. I shouldn't have let you go. I should have talked you out of it. We all would have ended up dead, he said, panting. You can't fight someone who can flip worlds. The whooping of the helicopter faded. Fowler ran. A group of four men and women wearing natty suits coming the other way paused as he approached.
Fuller cut into the street to pass them. "Slow down, Peter!" one of the men shouted as Fuller passed. "I'd better go." It was difficult to run, holding the phone to his ear. "I love you, Storm. I wish this had turned out differently." "Don't give up, Fowler," Storm shouted. "You sound like you're giving up."
Fowler cut up a stairwell between two buildings, pushed past an old woman, mouthed sorry, before pushing on.
"I'm just being realistic. You know, that wasn't exactly the reply I was hoping for." "I love you too," Storm shouted into the phone. "That's why you can't give up. Find a way out. You fell off a fucking world and found a way out of that."
"That's true."
He'd been lucky, though. He didn't feel lucky now.
"I have to go, I'm sorry, but I'm running for my life." "Run fast, Fowler."
Storm disconnected. With each step, his legs responded a little more sluggishly. He was nauseous, dizzy, clutching the handrail like the old woman he'd almost knocked over. He turned at the sound of gunshots in the distance. Peter, too, must have convinced the Peters to join him. Fowler wondered if he was still wearing the number one shirt. When he reached the road that led to defense, he ran headlong into a platoon of soldiers heading the other way, lined up single file. Shouts rose from the soldiers, rifles turned his way. He raised his hands.
"Easy, I'm on your side. I'm on my way to defense to—"
he stammered, not sure what a two would be going to defense to do.
"For support action. Communication, those Peters with the guns, I don't know if they've lost their minds or what."
The commander of the platoon waved his troops past as Fowler rambled on.
"Good luck," Fowler called.
He walked off, keeping his pace brisk but dignified until foliage blocked his view of the soldiers and vice versa. Then he broke into a run again. He thought about the armed guard at the gate, the soldiers at the checkpoint inside. He wasn't going to talk his way past them. Someone was going to get on a radio and check his story, even if he came up with something convincing. Movement in the road ahead caught his eye. More soldiers. Fowler looked around for somewhere to hide. A tall cyclone fence ran along one side of the road. Across the street, a squat concrete building sat among mountains of gravel and sand. Big yellow machines, bulldozers, front loaders, steamrollers lined the back of the lot. He ran through waist-high weeds to the concrete building. Inside, he found the remains of an office. There was a desk, an overturned swivel chair, a shattered computer screen. A bag of golf clubs leaned up in one corner, golf pictures on one wall. Fowler pulled the gun from his pants, sat against the wall to one side of the doorway. The gunfire he'd been hearing in the distance had gone silent. Maybe all the Peters who'd risen up were dead. Melissa had said this plan would only lead to more death, and she'd been right. The Peters were people trapped in a bad situation, nothing more. They didn't deserve to die. The footfalls of the soldiers in the road faded. Fowler peered out through the doorway. A spotlight traced a path across the sky before dropping out of sight. He needed to get moving. He pushed through weeds, wound behind old buildings and over low fences, staying parallel to the road, periodically eyeing the high fence topped with vicious curls of barbed wire on the other side. Either he needed to find a way over or through it, or he had to storm the gates of the compound, alone, with one gun. It occurred to him that he didn't even know how much ammunition he had. He paused, knelt in knee-high yellow grass, released the clip a snakebite had taught him. It was full. He had that going for him, at least. From down the road, Fowler heard voices. He dropped onto his stomach.
"Check those buildings,"
Fowler recognized the voice immediately because it was his own.
56, did you hear what I said? I want someone stationed every 200 yards.
Sorry, 56 said. Fowler heard footsteps to his left, swishing through the grass. He held his breath, stayed perfectly still as a voice called,
"Clear,"
from a dozen feet away.
"All right, let's move."
As the Peters moved on, Fowler raised his head ever so slightly. 30 Peters were heading farther down the road, with Peter 1, formerly Peter 2, leading. Peter 56 was 50 yards to Peter's left, standing in the middle of the road, a pistol holstered at his hip. Fowler was royally screwed. Now, he couldn't even get across the road, let alone into defense. Fowler's gaze lingered on a drainage pipe close to the road on his side. It disappeared under the road. "There we go." The voice in his head was Snakebite's. He could almost see Snakebite squatting beside it, asking,
How are you with closed-in spaces?
Fowler eyed the blackness inside the pipe. He honestly didn't know how he was with closed-in spaces. He belly-crawled through the grass until he reached the opening, then wriggled into the drain, his arms in front of him, his wounded shoulder screaming. It smelled like a cross between a swamp and a shithouse. Thick goo from the bottom slid down the neck hole in Fowler's shirt. The shoulder made crawling excruciating. He used his feet as much as he could, pushing against the sides of the pipe with his toes, walking himself forward on his elbows. It grew dark quickly. He couldn't help thinking about how much earth was between him and the road above, and what would happen if this pipe just kept sinking lower into some underground drainage system. There was no way he could back out, it was too tight. The pain in his shoulder was blinding. Blinking away a mix of tears and sweat, Fowler squinted into the darkness ahead and realized he could see a circle of dim gray light. Encouraged, he pushed on, his feet churning, scraping the drainpipe, his elbows raw. The circle of light grew larger, but not much brighter. He looked up, saw the pipe led into a larger, vertical pipe with a ladder set into the side of it. He saw this through the vertical slits of the metal grate. Reaching forward, he grasped the grate, tried to push it open. It rattled, but held firm. Shit! Fowler's heart was hammering wildly. Hang on, Snakebite's voice again. He imagined Snakebite lifting his torso until it pressed the top of the pipe, fumbling at his belt and pulling out a gun. Fowler couldn't hold himself up on his bad arm, nor could he use it to draw his own gun, so he rolled onto his back in the muck to pull it from his belt. Aware there was a decent chance the bullet would ricochet right back into his face, Fowler pointed the muzzle at the bottom hinge, closed his eyes, and fired. He squeaked like a startled pup at the deafening report, even though he'd been ready for it. The hinge was shredded. He shot out the other one, reached out and pulled open the grate, hoping he was far enough underground that no one had heard the shot. He surfaced behind an unlit concrete behemoth of a building. Getting his bearings, Fowler ducked around to where he could see the defense building. It was brightly lit. Through the glass doors, Fowler could see the guarded checkpoint. They'd be watching for his number two shirt. He scraped off some of the filth that streaked his shirt, smeared it across the two on one shoulder, then the other, obscuring both. Fowler took a few huffing breaths. You can do this. He jogged into the open, pushed through the front doors. We got him, he shouted, breathless, excited. The three people in the room, two men and a woman, all dressed in fatigues, lowered their assault rifles, their faces relaxing. Where was he? The woman asked. She looked Fowler up and down. Looks like he put up a fight. Fowler walked right up to the trio, smiling. He raised his gun and kept firing until all of them were dead. As he retraced the route down to the control room, Fowler struggled to keep himself together. They would have shot him if they'd had the chance, he told himself. Then they would have gleefully paraded his body down the road at the end of a rope. When he reached the heavy door, he paused again, trying to calm himself. There hadn't been anyone armed in the control center the last time he'd been there, but this time they knew Fowler might be on the way. It was harder to put a big smile on his face this time, but he did his best. We got him, he cried out as he hurried in. Everyone in the room looked up, including two Peters, A and C. There looked to be only one armed person in the room, a soldier watching a big screen over the shoulder of a woman, his assault rifle propped against the desk nearby. Fowler walked over and plucked the rifle away from the desk. The soldier jerked as if startled awake. He lunged for Fowler. Fowler took a step back, pointed the handgun at the soldier's chest. He eyed the big steel door. It was 6 inches thick, clearly intended to keep unfriendlies out, unless the unfriendlies happened to have a bazooka. This would be simpler if only a few people were locked in with him. Keeping his back to the door, Fowler brandished his pistol at the Peters. Who here knows how to work the weapons? Peter A. curled his lip at Fowler. Go to hell, Sandoval. Fowler aimed the pistol at his thigh. Either answer the question or I shoot you. You know me, I won't hesitate. The look Peter A. gave him was filled with such contempt, such bald hatred, that Fowler had to resist stepping back. Fowler raised the pistol, pointed it at Peter A.'s forehead. On the count of three, you're dead. Peter C. rolled his eyes up to meet Fowler's. It's not theoretical physics, Sandoval. All you need is me. Fowler glanced at him. Fair enough. You two stay. Everyone else out. I said everyone out.
Fuller barked, training the gun on the now unarmed soldier. The room cleared. Never taking his eye off the Peters, Fuller swung the heavy door closed and dropped a huge steel bar in place. "I'm guessing you're no more a fan of Ugo Wolkoff than I am," Fuller said to Peter C. Peter C. leaned back in his swivel chair. "Don't try to seek common ground with me, Sandoval. Just tell me what you want, and I'll decide if I'd rather do it or get shot in the head. I want you to kill Wolkoff." Peter C. shook his head. "This is a military facility. We deal in weapons of mass destruction. I can't kill one individual from a distance. I don't even know where Wolkoff is right now. For all I know, he's standing outside that door." Fuller pounded the table. "I want him dead. How do I do it?" He was flying blind. He knew nothing about this place, and he couldn't expect any help from the Peters. He didn't even know what the Singularity could do, and the only other weapon he knew about was... "The last time I was here, your colleague, Mr. B., threatened to use the blackout virus on Peter 17. Again, Peter C. shook his head. "Unless you can bring Wolkoff to this room so I can inject him with it, the B virus is no help to you." He shrugged. "I could release it, but in a few hours we'd all be blanks." He gestured toward the door. "And I mean all. That's a heavy door, but the room isn't airtight. Wipe Wolkoff and you wipe yourself." Fuller leaned against the desk. Wipe himself? The thought of going through day one all over again made Fuller want to shriek. He would forget Snakebite and falling. He would forget Storm. He didn't want to start again. An empty glass, a little boy lost and confused. What other option did he have, though? Stay there until he died of thirst? "What the hell? Let's hit the reset," Fuller said. "Wait," Peter C. said. "You're joking, right? You don't really want to do it." Peter C. studied him. "It's the only way you and the rest of the Peters will ever be their equals. We can all be ignorant together." Peter C. laughed dryly. "I don't want to be equal that badly." Fuller suspected it wasn't quite that simple. "Is it because you hate me too much to give me what I want? Even if it'll make both me and Ugo suffer?" Peter C. leaned back, drew a sack from under the console. Fuller snatched it from him. "My lunch," Peter C. said. "I'm hungry." Fuller looked inside, then handed it back. Peter C. drew out an egg, cracked it on the desk, began peeling off the shell. "At this point, I hate both of you about equally." He looked to Peter A. "Would you say that's accurate?" Peter A. waggled his hand. "Sandoval, still a little more." "Then send us both back to the Stone Age." Peter C. took a bite of his egg. "Was your memory wiped?" Fuller asked. Peter C. shook his head. "The copy of Peter that I'm a copy of had his memory wiped." "Then you remember how terrible it is to wake up after it happens." Fuller shrugged. "I'm asking you to inflict that on Ugo and me, both." Peter C. finished his egg. "And myself." "If you waste much more of my time," Fuller said, doing his best Snakebite imitation, "you can do it using the one finger I'm going to leave you." He slung the rifle over his shoulder. Still holding the handgun in his good hand, he propped his foot on a chair, withdrew Snakebite's knife, which was seized against his calf. It looked as if Peter C. had some difficulty swallowing the last bit of egg, with Fuller and his knife so close. The console buzzed. Peter A. checked it. "It's Wolkoff." He tapped a key and Wolkoff's image appeared on the screen mounted on the wall. "You think you're pretty damned clever, don't you?" "Evidently, I'm the smartest person alive," Fuller glanced at the Peters. "Although now I guess it's a 150-way tie." Wolkoff leaned closer to the screen. "Evidently. So I really did get you with the virus. I didn't realize until I found the map you drew." "It got me. But it didn't stop me." Wolkoff folded his arms. "And what are you going to do now, Mr. Genius?"
"I'm working on it."
Wolkoff grunted.
"I could bolt the door from the outside and leave you to rot. In fact, that's exactly what I'm going to do."
Fuller gestured at ANC. "I have hostages. Innocent men." He waited for what he knew was coming.
"Innocent men," Wolkoff waved a dismissive hand. "They're you, down to the last cell. I'm looking forward to the day when I can line every one of you in front of a firing squad, but for now, I'll settle for three."
Fowler couldn't suppress a half-smile. Let his companions chew on that little nugget for a moment. Would you mind refreshing my memory, since you took the liberty of erasing it? I understand you murdered the original me. What were we fighting about, exactly? Ugo uncrossed his arms, moved his face closer to the monitor. Among other things, you killed my wife. Fowler was sick of people telling him he'd been a cold-blooded killer before day one. He knew who he was, and people didn't change just because you wiped their memories. That was becoming clearer to Fowler by the day. You mean I took a gun or a knife or something and murdered her with it? You might as well have. Ugo's anger was coming to the surface. You're such an idiot. You have the worst judgment of anyone who's ever lived, and still you go barreling on, leaving ruined lives, a ruined world, in your wake. No more, though. Ugo's face vanished. Fowler turned to Peter C. Do you still hate me a little more? Peter C. raised his hand. Save it. I'll do it. You need help? Peter A. said. No, I've got it. Peter C. looked up at Fowler. Peter Sandoval and I are going to finish what he started. He shrugged. Who knows, maybe afterward, we'll all meet nice girls, settle down in houses along Jamestown Road, raise kids. Whatever happens, it has to be better than this. He leaned over the console. Fowler watched his hands sweep the air, his fingers tap. A sheen of sweat formed on Peter C.'s brow as the smile faded, replaced by tension, maybe fear. Finally, he swiveled to face Fowler. We're one function away from blackout. There's no taking it back once it's released. What's it going to be, Sandoval? Do it. And my name is Fowler. Don't call me Sandoval again. I'm no more or less Sandoval than you are. Peter C. spun back to his console, tapped the air once. He got up, went to the far end of the room, and peered in at the singularity. You said it would take a few hours? Fowler asked. 16 to 20, C. said from across the room. The air is so permeated that we're all going to be patient zero simultaneously. Whatever that meant. Can I make a suggestion? C asked. If I were you two, I'd move away from that door. Fowler looked at the door back at C. Why is that? Mr. A, who was already moving toward the back of the room, answered. Ugo's not going to be satisfied leaving you to starve. He's going to try to get that door open. Chapter 27. Peter woke with a start. He'd been dreaming that a hole had opened under his bed, and he was falling right down through the core of the earth. He woke to a reality no less bizarre. He found a new toothbrush under the sink, brushed his teeth using pink lemonade instead of water. Using the telescope, he checked out the street below. Most of the people who passed were carrying things or pushing carts. Peter felt no impulse to race outside and join them, although he was aware that every moment he delayed gathering food, water, and weapons reduced his odds of survival. He wasn't afraid. Guilt currently crowded out the possibility of any other emotion. There was no possible way he could build a new duplicator with the materials available on this island. So there was no chance of acquiring another singularity. Even if he had a singularity, the odds of ever understanding it well enough to repair the world seemed remote. What he should probably do is seek out President Aspen. Presenting himself to her wouldn't solve anything, but he could explain what happened, and using what authority she retained, perhaps she could help the rest of the population understand. Of course, doing that would dramatically increase the odds he would be hung from a street lamp or burned alive. It would be nice to have a handgun for protection. He went from room to room, looking in drawers and cabinets, hoping to get lucky. The apartment's second bedroom was a child's room. From the abundance of action figures and military vehicles, Peter guessed its resident had been a boy of 7 or 8. A toy paratrooper hung from the lamp on the nightstand. Peter unhooked it from the light switch, looked it over. The figure was about an inch long, dressed in brown camo fatigues and a matching helmet. His parachute was light green, round, with slits in 3 of the panels. He crumpled the parachute and figure together and tossed it toward the ceiling. The parachute deployed crisply. Peter swept the paratrooper off the floor and stuffed it in his front pocket as a plan began to form. What were the odds that Williamsburg was below Manhattan in this new world order? Maybe using the telescope he could examine each of the islands within range, identify them, and form some working hypothesis about how the various land parcels had shaken out. Maybe. Even if he had to jump blind, though, Peter would take the chance if he could locate a parachute, or make one. He had nothing to lose, and besides his lab, Melissa was out there somewhere. 5 Melissas were out there, actually. He knew she would never forgive him. Odds were she'd lost all faith in him after what he'd done. But he still needed to find her. Even if she despised him, he would give anything to see her, to be near her. He wanted to find his friends as well. For an instant, he couldn't remember Harry's and Kathleen's faces. Then they came rushing back, and with them Peter felt such sharp longing to see them, mixed with a strange, tangled grief from Harry's death. He still didn't know how to grieve for someone who was both gone and not gone. They were all gone now, unless he could find them. The sky was mesmerizing, so enormous from his vantage point, dotted with cumulus humulus like so many giant marshmallows. He felt like he was coming awake, but he hadn't been asleep. He'd been watching the clouds. Peter stood, dragged his hands down his face, tried to banish the fog from his mind. He had to get going, locate a parachute somewhere on this island in the sky, so he could find... A sick, crawling sensation slid through his gut. For a moment, he hadn't been able to remember who he wanted to find. He'd forgotten Melissa. He headed for the stairs. People were hard at work foraging for supplies. A young guy in a purple shirt and sunglasses passed on the sidewalk pushing a cart loaded with bottled water, a pistol pinned between his hand and the cart handle. An altercation on the corner half a block away caught his eye. Peter edged closer until he could hear a man and woman arguing. The woman was terribly distraught.
"Get away from me," I said.
The man held out his hand.
"Sabrina, please, I don't understand. What's the matter with you? It's me. It's Joey."
"Don't touch me. Leave me alone."
"Sabrina, you're sick or something. We gotta get you somewhere safe, to a doctor or something."
Peter jogged back in the other direction, then stopped, looked around, not quite sure where to go. He'd done it. He'd really done it. Peter tried to think of the man's name, but came a blank. Big guy, always wore a hat. If the symptoms were manifesting now, he must have released the blackout virus 16 to 20 hours before he sent Peter the warning. They'd had an argument, he and the big guy, but Peter couldn't remember what it had been about. A woman. A girl, 13 or 14, passed Peter on the sidewalk, crying hysterically. She reached up, pressed her palms over her ears, screeched, "Where do I live?" He had to think of a way to hang on to who he was. Then he remembered the singularity. Its energy could be used to alleviate some of this. It could be transported in fuel cells to these islands. He and the other Peter who'd helped move it were the only people who knew where it was hidden. He had to write it down before he forgot. Only victims of the blackout virus couldn't read. He wouldn't remember how to read in a few hours. The thought was terrifying. He took a few deep breaths, tried to calm himself. What if he drew pictures? Or a map? He pulled out his wallet. There was nothing big enough to write on, only his ID card and a few photos. One of him and his wife on their honeymoon. If she had known he still carried it around, she would have laughed that harsh, sarcastic laugh he'd only heard for the first time after everything went bad. He dropped the wallet and its contents on the sidewalk, saving only the photo. When he tried to put the photo in his pocket, his fingers brushed something already in there. He pulled out the paratrooper. He'd forgotten all about the parachute. Was there time to locate one? Peter closed his eyes, tried to get a sense of how quickly the virus was doing its work. He had no idea where he'd grown up, had no memory of being a child, of having parents. He was a physicist. He still remembered that. His name was... It wouldn't come. He had to hurry. Patting his pockets, he realized He had nothing to write with. He could go to the closest apartment building, find an empty apartment and kick in the door. That would take time. He might forget what he wanted to write down by then. He froze. What did he want to write down? Straining to remember, he spotted the paratrooper in his hand. It came back to him. There was a penknife on his keychain. He could cut his finger and use his blood. That was good. It would convey to his memory-wiped future self that the map was important, something he'd literally bled for. Glancing around, he spotted a discarded Milk Duds box in the gutter. He tore it open at the seam, flattened it on the sidewalk. He opened the penknife, and without hesitation, sliced into the pad of his thumb in one quick, violent pass. Blood pattered onto the sidewalk in thick drops, dipping the fingernail of his index finger into the blood. He started at the bottom, drawing a flag. He steadied his trembling hand by clutching it with the other, smearing both with blood in the process. As he sketched out the ovals to represent the world as it was now, he kept forgetting what he was doing and why. To fight against forgetting, he repeated aloud, "I'm drawing a map," over and over as he worked. Chapter 52. Fuller called Storm.
"Are you all right?"
Storm asked. "I'm fine. I need you to ask Melissa how long it takes after the blackout virus is released before it's no longer contagious." Fuller heard muffled conversation as Storm spoke to Melissa.
"About 4 days."
"It can't spread from one world to another, can it?" Although it was a little late to be thinking of that. Storm consulted with Melissa.
"Not unless someone who's infected carries it there."
"Why? What did you do?"
"I released it on Ugo's world." Melissa whooped. "The thing is, I'm still on Ugo's world."
"Hang on. You released the blackout virus on yourself?"
Fuller had started pacing without realizing it. He stopped. "It was everyone or no one. At the time, it seemed like the best of a lot of bad options."
"When I see you, you're not going to recognize me. It'll be day one for you all over again."
Her words set off a crawling dread inside him. Day one all over again. He'd almost rather die. "I could stand the thought of day one all over again, if it didn't mean forgetting you."
"I'll remember for both of us," Storm said.
"Listen, I'm the guy in the shirt with the number 2 on it. I don't want you to ride off into the sunset with one of these other clowns." "Very funny," C said. Chapter 53. Soon, Fowler wouldn't remember thinking the thoughts he was thinking now. It seemed impossible. He wondered if he could hang on to some of his memories, or even just one, through force of will. What if he held it firmly in his mind, repeated it while the virus did its work? If it were possible, which memory would he choose to keep above all others? Which memory of Storm was the quintessential moment in their time together? Storm inviting him to join her in Penny's bedroom? Their reconciliation while they fell from Snakebite's world? Fuller thought of their mid-air reunion, after Wilcoff tipped the Orchid world. If not for what had followed, that would be his fondest memory. A muffled explosion shook the room, knocking Fowler off his chair. "Here we go," C said from the spot on the floor where he'd landed. The steel door was still in place, but there was a deep, jagged crease toward the bottom. Fowler crawled a bit closer to inspect the damage. There was a 6-inch breach where the door had pulled away from the wall. He could see into the hall and heard voices, although he couldn't make out what they were saying. Peter C. coughed. "Here we go. A little tickle in my throat. That's how it starts. Another hour or so, and we'll be vegetables." Fowler eyed the door. "I'm not sure we've got an hour." Another explosion rocked the room, sending electronic equipment tumbling from the tables, shooting chunks of debris toward the back of the room, where Fowler, A, and C were sitting behind an overturned table. "That almost got it," a voice said from behind the door. "We can batter it down from here." "Can you see them?" a second voice asked. "No." From behind the table, Fowler flung the assault rifle toward the door, followed by the handgun. "We're not armed," he coughed again, the tickle in his throat was getting persistent. There was a bang as something hit the door. The massive hinges holding the door squealed.
Come on, let's try to look passive. Fowler pushed the table aside, got down on his knees, and put his hands behind his head.
The others followed his lead, A to Fowler's left, and C to his right. Hopefully, if they gave themselves up without a fight, Ugo would pass up shooting them on the spot in order to plan a more public and festive execution.
It's true what Ugo said, you know, Fowler said as they knelt on the floor. I don't know why you hate me. We're all the same guy. So you're just as responsible as I am. And really, from what Melissa told me, this is all Ugo's fault.
Who's Melissa? C asked. At first, Fowler thought C was being facetious, but he was serious. If no one here told you about Melissa, they've been telling you lies. The door crashed to the floor. Fowler held perfectly still as half a dozen soldiers rushed in, pointing automatic weapons at him. At all three of him. Two soldiers grabbed him under his armpits and dragged him out of the room. His knees and feet bumped the concrete steps as they dragged him to ground level and outside. Ugo was waiting outside, hands on hips, with at least 50 other people. They dropped Fowler at his feet.
Are you sure you have the right one this time? Ugo asked.
I thought you said we were interchangeable. Fowler pinched a piece of grass from his tongue.
Hands grabbed his ankles, pulled off his boots. The soldier walked around and handed Ugo the photo Fowler had been carrying since day one. Ugo coughed as he tore it in half and dropped the pieces into the grass.
Get up!
Fowler considered defying Ugo, but figured all he'd get for his trouble was a kick in the ribs from one of the soldiers. He stood. Ugo punched him in the face. The blow landed between his mouth and nose like a sack of rocks, knocking him backward a step. Another punch to his eye landed before he could recover. Fowler retreated a few steps as people cheered Ugo on. The thing was, there was almost as much coughing as cheering. Fowler had no idea whether he knew how to fight. He raised his fists close to his face, lunged, and threw a punch that glanced off Ugo's cheek. Ugo buried a fist in Fowler's stomach, doubling him over. It surprised Fowler how much it hurt. Much worse than getting hit in the face. Ugo was much bigger than him, and looked in shape for a guy with graying hair. And evidently, Fowler didn't know how to fight. Ugo kicked upward at Fowler's bent face, but missed badly. Fowler straightened, even though it sent jets of pain through his stomach, and raised his fists again. He needed to drag this out until the blackout virus knocked Ugo out for him. Fowler threw three or four punches in quick succession. Two landed with a satisfying smacking sound. Howling and red-faced, Ugo stiff-armed Fowler in the face, drove him backward until he tripped over someone's foot and tumbled to the ground. Ugo grabbed him by the hair, lifted his head, and punched him 3, 4, 5 times. The last punch caused a sickening cracking sensation in his mouth. Some of Fowler's teeth had broken. Ugo stepped back. His knuckle was gashed and bleeding, and he was panting heavily, but he was grinning. The grin wavered. A look crossed Ugo's face, as if he were trying to remember something, then it vanished. He kicked Fowler in the face. Fowler was gone for a moment, lost in pain, disoriented, not sure where he was or what was happening.
I'm going to beat you to death.
Ugo stood over him, hands on his hips.
I want you to be aware of what's happening. You're going to die right here in this grass.
Fowler touched his nose, which felt much too big and thick. It was numb on the outside, but pain raged deeper inside. Ugo kicked him in the stomach, higher up this time. Fowler felt a rib snap.
There was a time when...
Ugo trailed off, his mouth forming an O, his eyebrows clenched.
You're forgetting something, Ugo, Fowler said.
He waited for Ugo to catch on, but Ugo just stood there, his face pinched in concentration.
Fine. You'll...
Fowler trailed off. The thought he'd formed vanished. There was a fizzing, popping sensation in his head, as if he were feeling each individual memory as it was extinguished.
What am I forgetting?
Ugo asked, his tone almost pleading.
I'm not going to tell you.
The truth was, Fowler couldn't remember what he was going to say, but he wasn't going to tell Ugo that. He hated Ugo, although at the moment, he couldn't remember why. Ugo turned to one of the soldiers.
held out his hand. The soldier put a crowbar in it. "Hang on, I'll tell you," Fowler said. Ugo waited. Fowler strained to remember what he was about to tell Ugo. It was something he'd done, something Ugo wouldn't like. It was so hard to think, though. Something was wrong with him. Something... "The blackout virus. You're forgetting the blackout virus." Fowler could see the wheels turning in Ugo's head. "You released it? Here?" It felt as if the back of Fowler's head had vanished, replaced by inky blackness. Fowler reached up, pressed his fingers against the back of his head to make sure it was still there. It was. "I'm bringing 150 copies of you up to speed in astrophysics," Ugo said. "At the pace they're going, in 2 years they'll know as much about something as you knew. Then they'll put their heads together and..." Fowler could see the thought get away from Ugo as he pressed a palm to his forehead, trying to concentrate. "God damn it, you little fuck!" The big man swung the crowbar at Fowler's face. Fowler raised his hands to ward off the blow, caught the brunt of it on his fingers. The next blow landed on his kneecap, then his thigh, his hip, his ribs again, the pain blinding. He wrapped his arms around his head and steeled himself for the next blow. The pain was blinding, excruciating. When the next blow didn't come, he looked up. The big man stood over him, holding the crowbar, with the most peculiar expression on his face. "Where was I?" the big man asked. "I..." He licked his lips, looked at the crowbar. "Was I hitting you?" "No," it seemed the safest answer. "Why would you hit me?" "Him, yes," a woman in a uniform said, pointing. "He's..."
"Because you..."
The big man dragged his hand through his thinning hair.
"It was something. You did something to me. You took something."
The pain was terrible. Intolerable. What was happening to him? Then he remembered blackout virus. He was being erased. Soon there would be nothing left. Was there anything left now? He closed his eyes, tried to remember something, anything. "I was falling. I remember that." He was falling through the sky, the endless sky, toward a thin woman with black hair. He loved her. The crowbar thunked to the ground. The big man clapped his hands over his ears. Something was wrong. Had they been in an accident? Were they sick? Chapter 54. Chirping woke him. Stabbing, burning, throbbing pain radiated from so many places in his body, he couldn't focus on any one. He'd been in some sort of accident. Maybe he'd fallen. He peeled open one eye, expecting to find himself in a hospital bed. Instead, he was lying in the grass, surrounded by other people. He waited for memory to follow, for reminders of why he was badly hurt, who these people were, but nothing came. The chirping was coming from a thin metal rectangle lying in the grass near him. "Do you know me?" a voice asked. Slowly, gently, he got to his hands and knees, tried to rise. Stabbing, agonizing pain shot through his knee, and he dropped back into the grass. "Do you know me?" the man repeated. "No." The chirping stopped. There was another man nearby who looked exactly the same as the first. Sandy brown hair, a roundish face. He had an A on the sleeve of his shirt. The other man had a C. "Do you know either of us?" Fowler asked him. "No," the man said. The standing man, C, frowned. "How can you not know each other? You're brothers or something. You look exactly alike." Slowly, gingerly, he pointed at himself. The pain in his ribs doubled. "I look like him? So do you." He looked around. There was a building nearby, all glass and steel. Other buildings nearby. Nothing was familiar. He craved something familiar to stave off the awful lost feeling he had. Other people were walking around, speaking to each other in urgent tones. They all looked terribly confused and scared.
A click behind him made his shoulders clench. He turned. His twin with a C on his sleeve was holding up a rifle, examining it.
"It's loaded," C said.
"We must have been fighting someone. Maybe they did this to us," a big man said. He had a bruise on his cheek, a drooping, slightly swollen left eye.
Maybe there was something in his pockets that would give him a clue to who he was. He checked them and found 3 photographs. They were of children of varying ages with bronze-colored skin and black hair. The big guy was standing over him.
"Maybe they're your family."
Seeing what he was doing, the other men went through their own pockets. A had a half-empty pack of gum, 2 keys and a ring. C had an identical key ring and a pen.
"Are those your children?" the big man asked him.
He shook his head. "I don't know."
"Amnesia, that's the word for this," A said.
The word sounded strange, like it was the first time he'd ever heard it. Yet the man was right. That was the right word. The thin rectangle started chirping again. He picked it up, held it in his palm.
"Phone?"
The word sizzled in his mind, like he was giving birth to it. All 3 men nodded.
"You talk to people on it," C said.
"How?" He turned it over, looking for buttons, but it didn't have any. It stopped chirping.
"We should find food and water," the big man said.
Chapter 55. He needed something to drink, but the distance between his cot and the sink was 1,000 miles to his eye, the one that wasn't swollen shut. Pain. It was his whole world. A woman was shouting outside, her voice muffled. The sound drew closer. He wanted to go to the door to see what the commotion was, but that, like the glass of water, would mean more pain. Of course, he had to get the water sooner or later. Maybe he should get it over with and see who was shouting, and what they were shouting about while he was up. He swung his leg over, pushed himself into a sitting position, wincing from the stabbing pain in his ribs and knee. Grasping the broom handle he leaned on when he walked, he pushed himself to his feet and staggered to the door.
"Faller?"
a woman was calling. She was jogging beside a woman who looked exactly like her. Both of them looking all around, they were skinny, green-eyed, freckled. He hadn't noticed them before, which was odd, because they thought he'd met just about everyone in the world over the past few days. One of his lookalikes was following a few paces behind them. One of the women spotted him and stopped short.
"What number was on your shirt?"
"Excuse me?
On the first day, what number was on the sleeve of your shirt?"
He looked at the floor. The shirt was lying where he'd dropped it, when he discovered clean ones in a drawer of the room he chose.
2.
The woman's face lit up. She raced toward him.
"Faller! Oh my God!"
She grasped his arm and leaned in to study his face, hand over her mouth.
"Oh my God! How did you get like this?"
"I don't know." The woman wrapped her arms around him. Faller hissed through his teeth, grasped her arms.
"I could really use a hug right now, I admit it, but it hurts too much."
The other woman, who was hovering a few feet away, said,
"We need to get you out of here."
"Out of where?" The woman who'd tried to hug him touched his arm gently.
"We're your friends. We know what happened to you, and we'll tell you. But right now, we have to get you and a few other people off this world. Bad people are coming."
He fought back tears of relief. The thought of having friends who wanted to help him was overwhelming.
"Do you know my name?"
She let him go.
"You're Faller. I'm Storm, that's Melissa. And that handsome devil over there is 131.
She pointed at his lookalike.
Faller.
He liked the sound of it. He didn't think much of his face, but he liked his name.
"Can we save the introductions for the ride?" 131 said.
Storm smiled.
"He's our ride."
"Sure, that's all I am to you. A means of transportation," 131 said. "Once we're safe, you'll probably try to shoot me again." Laughing, Storm put a hand on Faller's shoulder.
"Can you walk?"
As she led him away, she explained what had happened. He wasn't surprised to learn he and Storm were in love, but his mind reeled when Storm went on to explain that he and Melissa were divorced. And that was just the beginning. Chapter 56.
Fowler watched the ground approach, the whine of the aircraft deafening. This is definitely it. Melissa studied the landscape through a window. I knew it was 5 or 6 islands directly up from where I was dropped off. We were in a hurry to get hidden, so we ended up clustered together.
Finally, Ugo said. I'm so airsick, I'm not sure I'll ever feel normal again.
Fowler studied the big man's profile. It was hard to grasp that they'd been mortal enemies. He looked like a pleasant enough fellow. It was a pretty world with 2 lakes and a lot of trees in the center. The rest of the land cut up into parcels with houses on them. When 131 swung the stairs into place, Melissa went out first, glancing this way and that, rifle pointed at the ground, as a crowd gathered. We're looking for a man named Harry, Melissa called. This tall. She held her hand out a bit higher than the top of her own head. Asian. He's probably at home, a gray-haired woman said. Who are you? We're... Melissa hesitated, cast about for the right words. We're the good guys, 131 said. Under his breath he added, at least I'm a good guy. The jury is still out on you. Shut up, Melissa said. I may still shoot you. A contingent of locals led Fowler, who was still getting accustomed to his crutches, Storm, Penny, and Melissa to Harry's house, which backed onto one of the lakes. Some children had run ahead, and as Fowler and his companions approached the house, a man came barreling down the street laughing and screaming like a lunatic. Melissa had told Fowler they were friends, so he tucked one crutch under his arm and held out his hand to shake. Harry just kept coming, arms open. He might have plowed right into Fowler if Storm hadn't stepped between them. Gentle, gentle, he's injured. Oh my God, I can't believe it. Harry kissed Fowler on the forehead. You don't remember me, do you? Don't take it personally. I don't remember anyone. Yeah, there's a lot of that going around. Harry nodded sympathetically. He went and hugged Storm and Melissa. You'll never guess what we have on our aircraft, Melissa said. Harry tilted his head. Tons of food, I hope. Vodka would be nice. Maybe some Xanax? I'd kill for a Xanax. Melissa waved her hands at him. Think big. What one thing would you most want us to have with us? Harry frowned, thinking. Then his eyes got huge. No. Seriously? You got it? Seriously? Can we use it? We can't go back to Peter's lab. Elba is in control there. Are there other places we can go where you can find the equipment you need? Absolutely, just find me an R1 university with a decent physics department. UNC, Chapel Hill, UVA. We also have Peter's notes, Melissa said. Harry clutched his chest. Seriously? Is there any chance we can fix this mess? Harry considered. It'll take time, years, because God knows we've learned our lesson about rushing things. I don't know. It's possible. Chapter 57. Melissa was standing by the cargo door, staring out at empty blue sky, one hand on the wall. She went on staring as Fowler joined her. You look sad. The worst parts are over, you know. Still, she didn't look at him. It was supposed to be you and me who ended up together, not you and one of my duplicates. She sighed. It makes sense, though. She's me without the past. You're you without the past. It's like when we first met. The words surprised Fowler. Since they'd gotten divorced, he'd assumed Melissa didn't like him much. I'll be the first to admit I'm still getting a grasp on all of this. But I'm not the original Peter, the one you met in high school, right? Melissa sighed. You insisted you were. You told me I was getting hung up on bodies and being too literal-minded. Peter pointed at 131. So how am I different to you from that guy over there? Melissa glanced at 131. We have a shared past. Mostly a bad one filled with pain, but we fought Ugo together. Aren't you getting hung up on bodies again? I mean, either you're willing to accept that I'm just a continuation of the original Peter, or you're not. And if you are, Fowler pointed at 131 again. So is he. Noticing Fowler pointing, 131 raised his eyebrows,
then jokingly looked over his shoulder before pointing at himself in a "who, me?" gesture. "Look at him," Fowler said. "He's in love with you. When a Peter looks at a Melissa, he can't help but love her. We need to locate all the Melissas and introduce them all to Peters." Melissa burst out laughing. At the sound of her laughter, 131 glanced her way again. "I'm serious. We're meant to be together. Look at him, he loves you. We're all in love with every one of you, every damned one of us." Melissa leaned over and kissed Fowler's cheek. "And I love every damned one of you, too. Just," she shook her fist in mock frustration, "think before you jump." "I'll try." It was hard to learn from your mistakes when you didn't remember making them. At least now he knew what most of them were. Maybe that was enough. Chapter 58. They hovered 1,000 feet above the world, which was packed with towering buildings on one end, punctuated by one skyscraper that seemed much too tall to stay upright.
"This has to be it," Penny said.
Storm pointed. "There's the building you parachuted from." He eyed the distance between the building and the nearest edge of the world. How had he ever managed to make it that far? He wished he could remember. As Storm took the Harrier down, Fowler watched the upturned faces, the shock and wide-eyed wonder of the people in the streets. They sat down at the foot of the skyscraper that had started all of this. A rumble went through the gathering crowd as Fowler stepped out.
"Fowler! It's Fowler!"
It made him sad that he didn't remember them.
"Does anyone know where I can find Daisy?" he called.
A teenaged boy broke away from the crowd and ran off.
"He's going to fetch her,"
an old man shouted. They waited expectantly for him to say something.
"I guess you're surprised to see me back here."
Murmurs of assent rolled through the crowd.
"Well, I'm surprised to be here. I never expected to make it back. The important thing is, I'm bringing good news. From here on out, things are going to get better. There's going to be enough food, plus medicine and electricity. People to teach you how to plant crops."
"Fowler!"
A young brown-skinned girl pushed through the crowd, launched herself into his arms.
"Daisy!"
She was nothing but skin and bones, not starving, but not far off. She looked at him, eyes wide.
"You died. I saw you."
"You saw me fall. I didn't die."
"Hello, Daisy," Storm said.
"This is Storm," Fowler said.
"Hello, Storm."
Daisy looked her up and down, eyes wide.
"You're the woman in Fowler's picture. You're so clean."
"Thanks," Storm laughed.
"We're going to get you clean as well. Would that be okay?"
"Oh, sure." Penny and two other crew members had begun unloading food and medicine. Over Daisy's shoulder, Fowler spotted a bewildered-looking Asian woman at the edge of the crowd. She took an unsteady step forward.
"Hello, Kathleen." "Peter?"
One of her hands was moving frantically at her side. "I'll answer to that name, but I prefer Fowler." Kathleen bolted toward him, open-armed, and just about crushed his still-screaming ribs with a hug. Ugo stepped out of the Harrier, his arms full of supplies. Kathleen shrieked, backpedaled 6 steps. Ugo frowned, confused by her reaction.
"Don't worry about him," Fowler said. "He's fine. Go ahead, Ugo."
"She startled me,"
Ugo grumbled as he set the boxes down and went back inside the Harrier for more.
"What's going on?" Kathleen said. "Is it safe now? How do you know my real name?"
"I don't know about safe. Definitely safer. And I know your name because I bumped into Melissa on my way down. She's back at our HQ. She says hi."
Kathleen lowered her voice.
"What is he doing here?"
"Keep your friends close and your enemies closer.
Melissa told me that. I didn't come up with it myself." Fowler put an arm across Daisy's shoulder. "You want to take a ride with us once we're finished here?"
"Oh, sure."
"You're going to live with me and Storm. Plus you have a brother and 2 to keep you company."
He looked at Kathleen. "You too. We need your help. We're getting the band back together."
Fowler looked up at the skyscraper. It made him dizzy and a little queasy to stare up at that sheer, towering wall. He couldn't believe he'd actually jumped off it wearing a homemade parachute. But then again, he could. The End. This is George Goodell. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Fowler by Will McIntosh. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more, so look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.